Hello?
Yes.
Okay. Awesome. Well, you're on the air, WHRW 90.5 FM, and this is Vince here, and then we get Nastasha here, and we'll have the last host here, Justin here, coming back. But if you want to introduce yourself to the audience.
Sure. My name is Wilma Subra. I have Subra Company in New Iberia, Louisiana, and I provide technical assistance to community groups dealing with environmental issues.
All right. And I guess the first thing we can start with is the study that was done in Dish, Texas. I had went over an overview of the first two areas, 9203 Chisholm, and then the airfield area, and briefly discuss some of the chemicals that were involved and what those chemicals were. But could you go into detail into what that study was about?
Sure. The study was designed to evaluate the concentration of volatile organic carbon or volatile organic chemicals in the air around the compressor stations in Dish. And actually, the community members described the locations as compressor stations and metering stations, and there are actually 11 individual facilities spread throughout the community of Dish. And the community has been consistently complaining of the noise from the compressors and the health impacts associated with the operations of the compressors. So the study was designed to take a look at what was in the air in the residential areas and then at the airfield, which was adjacent to the residential areas, near these compressor stations.
And who funded the study?
The city of Dish actually used 10% of their budget for the year to fund the study, and it was performed by an organization known as Wolf Eagle Environmental.
Wow. And I remember reading in the report that Wolf Eagle and you are you associated with Wolf Eagle, or did you go through the report and go through their data and then put together a report based upon it?
Well, the mayor actually provided me with a copy of the report, and what I did was put it in a format that typical I use when I deal with community groups so that they could clearly understand, because it is an outstanding report. But what I did was pick the different individual locations. There were 7 locations, and talk individually about the ones that had the highest concentrations and then the chemicals that were detected in excess of what is known as TCEQ, which is Texas organization that deals with environmental quality. The Railroad Commission deals with the drilling of wells, and the TCEQ deals with things like air emissions. So they have actually permitted these facilities to emit these chemicals. And when you look at the benzene, which is a known human cancer-causing agent, it was highest and second highest in those two locations, the 9203 Chisholm and the airfield near the corner southeast. And in addition, those exceeded the screening levels by quite a large amount. The short-term screening level is for an hour. The long-term screening level is an annual average or a yearly average. And the benzene concentrations exceeded, as well as a lot of the sulfur compounds. And the community will consistently tell you that they're complaining of rotten egg smells. The sulfur compounds are basically the rotten egg smells. So when you talk to the community members, they divide what they are smelling into sulfur smells and natural gas smells. So the analysis that was performed on these 7 samples spread in the residential area in the airfield clearly showed that the concentrations in the air were detrimental to the health. As a result of this, I also developed a health survey, which the mayor and the council members and the staff and the city actually passed out to the door in the community of Dish. And looking at the initial health surveys that have come in, again, the community calls the locations compressor stations and metering stations, and their odor complaints consist of, like, sulfur smells and natural gas smells. And then when you ask them, well, what are your health impacts when you smell the sulfur smell, they consistently say that the health impacts they are having when they smell the sulfur smell is like burning eyes, runny nose, sore throat, headaches, and asthma. And then when they describe the natural gas smell, which is after they've added the mercaptans, which gives the natural gas an odor, they talk about nausea, headaches, and asthma. And then when you go into the rest of the health survey, these same chemicals, these same health impacts keep getting reported by this community over and over and over again. When you look at the chemicals that actually exceeded the screening levels, and you look at the health impacts associated with those chemicals, the acute health impacts are the things that happen right away after you smell it, consist of like irritating the skin and the eyes, irritating the nose, irritating the throat and the lungs, headaches, dizziness, lightheadedness, nausea, vomiting, skin rashes, fatigue, tense and nervous, personality changes and depression. And these are actually the health impacts that the community is reporting. So while the community didn't know what chemicals were in the air, they actually reported the health impacts that are associated with the chemicals that were detected by the sampling. So it all matches and fits together, and it's definitely a cause and effect.
And this was found, this is in Dish, Texas, and this is where they're going to their compressor station. So this isn't necessarily relating to the actual drilling, which is something I kind of wanted to bring to this area where people might disregard the report as saying, well, that's Texas and this is New York. But compressor stations are going to be something that are going to have to be prevalent wherever there's drilling. So there's going to be areas in New York and Pennsylvania where there are going to be compressor stations like there are in Dish. So this can be something that can be relevant into this area as well, right?
Correct. You need the compressor station to actually push the natural gas through the pipelines. So where you have drilling sites and where you have production sites, and when the production site starts making the natural gas and you put it in pipelines, flow lines, and then major transmission lines, you will have these compressor stations located at various intervals along the pipelines. And in Dish, there's a number of major pipelines that come together in that area, and that's what these compressor stations are used to remove the moisture, to remove the sulfur, which is called removing the sulfur odors and making the natural gas sweet, and then actually compressing it to move it through the pipelines. So, yes, in New York, where the Marcellus is, you will have a large number of compressor stations along the pipelines that are transmitting the natural gas that is produced by the wells.
And these are also somewhat like refineries when you say that they're removing the water and they're removing other things that are in with the natural gas. There's a whole refinery process that's going on at these compressor stations, yes?
A sort of a small refining process, and frequently people will call those refining stations. When you produce the natural gas, you also have a lot of condensate, which has the benzenes, the toluenes, and the sulfur compound in it. And then at these compressor stations, they take the condensate out and put it in tanks. And if you don't have vapor recovery facilities on the tanks, the volatile emissions are released by the tanks. So then you have that, and then at the compressor stations, you remove, like I said, you're removing the water and the sulfur. So it's sort of like a mini refining process, because what you want flowing through the pipelines is clean, dry natural gas. So it leaves the other things at the compressor stations.
In your professional opinion, in your personal opinion, how would you describe this, what the information that you've seen? How would you interpret this? You had said that this is definitely relating to the chemicals that were noticed, but to what extent and to what degree is this? How serious of a situation is this? And what can you tell people that might not... understand how serious of a situation this is?
Well, when you look at the chemicals and you look at how much they exceed the screening levels, some 100 to 300 times the screening levels, it's very significant, and it's very health impacting to those community people when you look on one chemical and one health effects. When you start looking at the 20 plus chemicals that exceed the screening level and consider the cumulative effects, it really has a huge health impact on that community. And it can say that same kind of health impact for people that are not in, quote, incorporated areas or areas that are called by a city name but live near compressor stations. They have the potential to be exposed and have these same type of health impacts. As well as a number of these chemicals are known and suspected to cause cancer. So when I was reading you the health impacts, I was reading like the acute health impacts. And then over time, you start getting the cancers developed.
Right.
I just spoke with a woman in South Central Pennsylvania the other day, and she dealt with just recently a CNG compressor station having an explosion and covering the ground around the homes for quite a distance away from the facility with an oily substance. Tests later revealed that there's toluene as well as other things. Are these compressor station blow-ups something that you've experienced down in Louisiana and Texas or have heard about?
Absolutely. We frequently have compressor stations that either have an explosion or have an overpressurization, and either the chemicals that are there on the facility, a lot of times it's the different fuel oils and greasing materials that they use, will blow out of the compressor station. So frequently the community calls them explosions, but the industry will say, oh, it just blew out. But it will actually coat the surrounding environment. In one case, it coated a man's home, it coated his car, it actually coated all the vegetables in his garden, and he had to destroy the garden. And this is the kind of stuff that gets very sticky and is very difficult to remove. And he actually had a big attic fan going at that time, so it spread it throughout the inside of his house as well. But these are the kind of activities that frequently occur near compressor stations, in addition to the ongoing volatile emissions that come out of the compressor station.
Just hearing about the CNG facilities as being part of the infrastructure with natural gas is really shocking. Are there other facilities that are part of the industrial system surrounding natural gas production that folks should know about?
Well, one of the things that I've constantly encouraged is when the regulations require you to get a permit to drill, that the company should have to tell you where they're going to receive the water that they're going to use for a hydraulic fracturing. Will it be from a surface water source? Will it be from a groundwater source? And secondly, where they're going to dispose of that water and what roads they're going to use to transport the waste for disposal, so that people who will live on the transport routes will know. And then where the pipelines are going to be run. Frequently, they just come in and they permit a well, and they don't tell the community all these other issues. And so then when you talk about where the pipelines are going to be run, also where the compressor stations are going to be located on that pipeline. So when you want to permit XYZ well, the community, the local government, and the state government have a right to know all of the different aspects of the results of that well producing gas and what the infrastructure will do to the surrounding area.
I guess to bring this towards a more new, you had sent me a report that you had sent to the or you had given to the New York State Senate. Can you discuss that?
Yes, I was requested to comment, and the Senate hearing was actually dealing specifically with the water issues. It was called a clean water hearing. So I submitted information sort of keying out some of the issues. One, protecting the quantity of surface water and groundwater, because what we're hearing a lot in the development of the Marcellus Shale is they're using surface water resources to get the 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, 5 million gallons of water necessary for hydraulic fracturing, and they're actually impeding the flow and a lot of the streams and rivers, and actually drying up the rivers that the people who live downstream that have use for that water are not being able to use it. And then if you use a huge quantity of groundwater, you start drawing down that aquifer, and people who have shallower wells find that their wells have suddenly gone dry. So look at the resources that are going to be used for that water, and then after the hydraulic fracturing process, you get flowback water, which contains all the fracking fluids, which are corrosion inhibitors, surfactants, all types of antibacterial agents. And then a lot of times they are trying to send that to some wastewater treatment plant, sort of like a sewer plant. And it goes through the sewer plant primarily untreated and is impacting the quality of the receiving water stream. Or if you put it in an injection well, you have to be sure that the injection well is isolated from the groundwater resources. So it was focused a lot on that, but also on requiring the companies to actually tell you what chemicals they're using in the hydraulic fracturing process. Because if you look at the material safety data sheets of these surfactants and these scale inhibitors, it's all proprietary, so that if you have a potential of contamination from the fracking process or from dealing with the fracking fluids, you don't know what specific chemicals are in that fluid, so that you can start looking in at the chemicals and seeing what areas they're contaminated. Are they contaminating surface water? Are they contaminating groundwater? Because the material safety data sheets don't specify the chemicals. So looking at all of those types of issues, looking at the impacts of groundwater resources that the fracturing and the drilling processes have, and actually managing what types of technologies are going to be used. It shouldn't go to a wastewater treatment plant like a sewer plant. It should go to a special treatment facility designed specifically to remove the chemicals that are in the fracking and produced water, so that they don't contaminate the surface water resource into which the wastewater treatment plants discharge. So it focused on the water, but it also heat up the issue of air, because as we saw from the DISH study, you have a lot of air emissions, and when these chemicals are released into the air, they deposit on the ground and in the surface water. So I wanted to make sure that they, when focused on water, they didn't ignore the potential pathway of chemicals from the air and impacting the water resources. And I'm hoping to hear back from the staffers to sort of interact with them as they try and develop whatever type of regulatory programs they're going to try and get through. And then one of the other issues is buffer zone and setback requirements, because frequently we see a drilling rig right next to a home, right next to a school, right next to a church or a park. And there should be buffer zones established between the drilling rig and those types of facilities.
Thank you so much for advocating on behalf of folks in New York and all the wildlife in New York. I had a question concerning the injection wells. There's been a lot of talk about injecting hazardous waste into dry wells here in New York, and the hazardous waste being the waste fluid from the drilling process and the fracking process. And I read that you had been working with the EPA in terms of injection wells in the past, and I was wondering if you had any information about hazardous waste going into injection wells and how those wells can affect communities surrounding.
Okay, I couldn't quite hear all of what you're saying, but what I think, the injection wells have been a big issue for a very, very long time. We've phased out a lot of injection wells in Louisiana and Texas when the companies were required to report what kind of chemicals they were actually injecting into the well and what quantities of chemicals. From the perspective of the oil field waste, the main injection wells that are used by the oil and gas industry are permitted to receive produced water. And constantly they say, well, produced water is only salt water, but it has a lot of toxic chemicals, a lot of heavy metals, a lot of volatiles. And these same type of facilities are being asked to accept the flowback water from the hydraulic fracturing, and without any requirement to chemically characterize water before it goes down the well, to be sure that it won't impact the casing on the well and that it won't interact with the formation into which it is being injected. Because what you don't want is fluid in the injection fluid actually reacting with the formation in which it is going. In Louisiana, in North Louisiana, where we have the Haynesville Shale being developed right now, there are not formations that can adequately take the produced water and the flowback fluid. So the majority of that waste is being trucked to Texas. And I know in the Marcellus area, there's a lot of concern about whether in the areas that is being targeted for drilling and production, there aren't adequate injection wells. So how far will they have to haul it, and will they have to haul it into other states? And at the national level, a state cannot refuse or regulate what waste comes in from outside, from other states.
Whoa.
So you get into that issue is that, well, is one state going to have all the benefits of the production and get all the money from the leasing and all, and yet send all its waste into one of the bordering states that is also over the Marcellus?
And is there issues relating to labeling something as toxic waste and how that gets shipped in between states. Is that come into play with the toxic wastewater, as far as if one state wants to get rid of the water, does it have to be labeled? Does it have to be given a certain certification or label before it can leave the state? And how does that play into the whole that scenario?
Well, that's a real problem, because at the federal level, the states are prohibited from regulating oil field waste as hazardous. By analysis, if you analyze the samples, 40 to 70% would analyze as a hazardous waste, but because of the federal requirement, the states cannot regulate it as hazardous. So all of this waste that's produced from the drilling and production of oil and natural gas goes under the non-hazardous, and most of the states have a manifest system, but it's not a hazardous waste manifest system. It's an oil field waste manifest system. So you'll never see a sign or a placard on the side of a truck hauling this waste that says hazardous.
And these wastes can just go to a normal landfill, yes, because they don't have the designation? Or...
Wait, could you ask that a little
louder,
please?
Did these wastes, they can just go to a normal landfill as opposed to going to a hazardous waste landfill?
No, well, the liquid waste from oil and gas drilling the production usually goes to an injection well, and there's starting to have a technology develop that uses reverse osmosis. However, the cuttings from the drilling process and some of the other hydraulic fracturing mechanisms, some of that waste could actually go to a landfill if it was permitted by the environmental agency within the state to receive oil field waste. Normally, it's permitted to receive like solid waste and industrial waste from industrial facilities. But if it has in its permit that it is allowed to take oil-field waste, then some of the solid and semi-solid waste streams can go to a landfill.
And you had talked about the tailings and the cuttings from these wells, and Nastasha had brought up a point earlier in the show about the radioactive aspect of these cuttings, that when you're cutting, going through all the ground and you're bringing up all these radioactive particles that are within the area, this isn't really talked about a lot as far as relating to the toxicity of the drilling. There's a lot of talk about the chemicals and the proprietary information, but not as much about the radioactive aspect of it. Can you speak on to that?
Sure. And the radioactivity that's associated with the oilfield waste is called naturally occurring radioactive material, and it consists of radium-226 and 228, which are known cancer-causing agents of bone seekers, and they have a half-life of like 1,620 years, so they're going to be around for a long time. So they occur actually in the formation that they're drilling into. So then the cuttings that come back up could be radioactive, but they're not required to be handled specifically like radioactive waste you would normally encounter. In addition, when the produced water and the fracturing fluid come back to the surface, they have dissolved in those fluid streams portions of this norm. And when it comes to the surface and it changes temperature and changes pressure or goes through an elbow, changes direction, it starts precipitating out in the piping and in the heater treaters and in at some of the units at these compressor stations. And it actually concentrates, and it's called scale. And that needs to be specifically addressed. And you don't hear any discussion of, well, how is the norm scale material that builds up in all these units going to be handled, and how is it going to be disposed of, and do the disposal facilities have the appropriate permit to receive them?
I had a question about going next to these drilling waste pits. Is there any potential for actually breathing in the norms, the uranium and radium that has become dust?
Breathing in the norm?
Yeah, does it mm-hmm. become dust, and does it become airborne as the pits are evaporating?
So it's a very dusty material once it dries out. And when you have tank bottoms and you clean out the tank bottoms, there's frequently the norm deposits in that. When you have heater treaters or when you actually pull up the casing in the well, it has this precipitated out norm. And then when you take it to a pipe facility, they actually ream it out, and that's where it becomes very dusty. Frequently it's dumped on the ground. And then the exposure pathways are inhalation and ingestion. And if you go to these pipe yards, you see the guys smoking while they're reaming it out. You see them stopping and eating lunch. And we've had a lot of cases where it's all over their clothing. And then when they go home, it's in their car. They wear the clothing in the house. They take off their jacket. It's on the carpet. And then you see the baby in the family crawling on the carpet, you know, dropping its pacifier on the floor or its bottle and putting it in its mouth. So the inhalation and ingestion of the dried out particles is extremely offensive to both workers and their families.
What about for folks who are living downwind from the pits or from the drilling?
Yeah, and we've actually seen where it actually has blown off the pipe yard facility onto neighboring properties, and that also gets drug into the house and on people's shoes. And then once you notify them, you see them trying to leave their shoes outside. But every time there's a big wind, there's a big dust storm, and it gets brought into their house again.
So this is awful for workers and for residents in the area. Thank you so
much. A little louder, please.
Oh, I said this is awful for workers and for residents in the area.
If do you want to talk to a little bit about the Oil and Gas Accountability Project? Don Young from Fort Worth Can Do had mentioned that getting involved in groups and how his group, you start a smaller group and get involved with larger groups like Oil and Gas Accountability Project. Is that, tell the audience a little bit about that?
Sure, and I'm a founding member of the Oil and Gas Accountability Project, and it was formed to deal specifically with oil and gas drilling and production activities. And the first was the coalbed methane development out west and in Alabama and in the eastern coast, because there wasn't any organization that was dealing with that. And as the Oil and Gas Accountability Project has grown over the years, we've actually incorporated these smaller community groups into the larger group, and we provide them with technical assistance, we provide them with workshops, we provide them with the things they need to know in order for them to deal with the issues on the local level. And actually in Texas, we formed a Texas OGAP arm of the Oil and Gas Accountability Project, which is a portion of Earthworks. And I'm on the Earthworks board as well. So Don has been one of the really great key members. Sharon also, and I think you had interviewed her last night, she told me.
Yep.
They are actually key members of the Texas OGAP dealing with drilling and production in the Barnett Shale.
Wow. Well, we're coming up to about 8 minutes left of showtime, and I really appreciate you having you on, and I'm glad you called and we're able to do this. Is there anything you want to leave with the audience or anything that you're working on currently that you'd like to tell people about or things that we haven't discussed that you'd like to bring up right now?
I think people have to be very proactive when the landman comes and tries to lease their property and find out exactly what's being proposed. Frequently, people don't own the mineral rights, so they don't even have a say in when the minerals are leased and when the company comes and starts drilling on their property. But people have to make sure that they know what's going on. And if they have any questions, they can go on the Earthworks website and look up Oil and Gas Accountability Project, and you'll see a number of people they can call: Gwen Lackle, Jennifer Goldman. They can call myself. Or if they're in Texas, they can call Don Young or Sharon, so that you know in the very beginning, don't wait until the rig rolls onto your property, because there are a lot of environmental issues, there are a lot of human health issues, and there are a lot of economic issues associated, particularly with shale gas drilling and production right now in a large number of states in the United States. So we'll be glad to help any of them understand what the issues are and provide them with the education they need to deal with them.
All right. Well, we really appreciate you having you on, as everyone.
Thank you so much, Wilma. We know that you're a really, really busy lady and doing a lot of work for folks all over the country, and really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us and talk with folks here in Binghamton.
Well, thank you all for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.